One of the refreshing remarks or refreshing marks of a young person is their idealism, right? If you look back at your life, I know when I look at my life, around the time I graduated high school, first couple years of college, I had this idea of idealism, right? And some of you guys have to look back a little bit further maybe, but I have this idea of how the world works and it's going to be perfect and we're going to do so much in our life at that time. And so for those of us that look back at a young person that has that idealism, that has that sense of zeal in their life, even if we know that it's not going to probably work out the way they expect, we get inspired. Our faith is and our hope is increased because of the things that they're expressing and the ways, the views that they have in life. Someone has said that ideals are like stars. We can never reach them, but like the mariners of the sea, we can chart our course by them. And so how we view the world and how we look at it can change and is different at different times in our life and from person to person. All of us could probably say that the world, our real world, isn't quite as perfect as we once thought it was. A pastor, a jaded pastor at that, once had the slogan, "My original life's goal was in silver banners, win the world for Christ." A few years later, he said, "Well, win one or two people for Christ." And like I said, he's jaded. Eventually it says, "Well, let's try not to lose too many." It's overly pessimistic, we know, but there's also some wisdom in that and truth in that. I think some of us live by Murphy's Law. You guys know what Murphy's Law is? Anything that can go wrong will go wrong, exactly. And some of us live by that mantra. I know when I think of going to the store, it seems like the line that I pick is the worst line to go in, right? It's the slowest one. It looks like, oh, there's only a couple people, but then the cashier has problems or something else comes up. Or I see this in traffic. I'll switch lanes when there's, you know, in heavy traffic or an accident or something. And I'll go and I'll pass like six cars. Then all of a sudden the car that I was just behind goes right past me. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong. And so we can approach our world in different ways. The mentality we have, the viewpoint we have. We can see all the pain and we can see all the hurt and we can become pessimistic. We see the insurmountable issues and we view the world from that lens. Or we can see that there's a lot of hope and joy and love in our world. And we tend to then ignore the pain. We push aside the negative feelings. I think there's several of us that, like I said, we're late to Murphy's Law. And other of us that we just don't see the world that way. Perspective is important, and that's what we've been talking about the last several weeks, that perspective is important. Resolutions, New Year's resolutions, especially focus on, well, what can I do about me? How do I change me and get myself better, my weight or my finances or relationships? We ask the question, what can I do about me? But we've been talking about the last several weeks is not so much what can I do about me, as it was what can I do around me, what can be done around me? Or we ask the question, what breaks your heart? What breaks your heart? And looking at our world and looking at the things around us is what breaks our heart. And we say this, we've said this the last couple weeks, if we really want to become a better person, New Year's resolutions are about us becoming a better person, but if we really want to become a better person, we need to do something to make the world a better place. And so if you've been here the last several weeks, if you've kind of struggled with that question, what breaks your heart, if you've tried to wrestle with it a little bit, maybe you've come up with some of these questions or these problems. Maybe you don't know what breaks your heart. Maybe you don't know what needs to be done around you. We're busy, right? We're trying to juggle all these different things in our life with family and work and friends and the house and everything else we're trying to juggle. Or we have other interests. We can't spend more time or more effort on something new. So we don't know what breaks our heart. And even if we find that out, even if we figure out, well, that breaks my heart. You know, this specific thing, this specific person breaks my heart. But maybe if we figure that out, we just don't know what to do about it. There's a mountain, we just can't tackle it. It's insurmountable. It's a huge problem. And we say, well, you know, I've got one or two hours this week. Or maybe we're so busy that we say, well, next Tuesday, or the third Tuesday of February, I can squeeze you in for a lunch. Right? It seems like we're that busy, right? Got to plan that far ahead. We just feel like there's so much going on. that we don't know what to do or don't know how to figure out to do anything about what breaks our heart. And if that's you, if that's your situation, that's what we're doing this morning. We're talking about to try to funnel everything down. We've kind of painted broad strokes the last few weeks. We're going to try to funnel it down this morning to try to find something tangible to do. And so we're jumping back into Nehemiah. We talked about Nehemiah a few weeks ago. If you want to go to Nehemiah, we're going to spend some time in that book. But just to refresh us on who Nehemiah was, well, he was the cupbearer to the king, which means he was a servant, but he had a pretty high place, a pretty high place in that culture, in that situation. And he's living around the 5th century B.C., which is about 400, 450 years before Jesus. So towards the end of our Old Testament, towards the end of our Old Testaments, there's a gap in between the Old and New Testament, about 400 years, and so Nehemiah is towards the end. Even though he's not physically in our Bibles towards the end, chronologically he is. And we saw the first week of our study that Nehemiah had something that just burdened him, that broke his heart, that he had a passion for, and that was rebuilding the walls of his ancestral home, Jerusalem. He'd probably never been there. He'd probably never set foot in that because his people, actually probably his grandma or his great-grandma and grandparents, they were taken out of that country. And so he's been living in a foreign land his whole life, and probably his parents and his grandparents have. But he has a passion for his ancestral home, to go back to Jerusalem, to rebuild the walls, because they're embarrassing. They're shameful. There's chaos there, and they're exposed. And so we jump into Nehemiah chapter 2, and we're going to start in verse 17. And this is Nehemiah writing here. He says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace.'" We see Nehemiah laying the framework, the foundation for what needs to be done. He has the passion. He has the heart for this community. Like I said, he's probably never even been there. He definitely wasn't forced to live there. He's chosen to go back and to reach to those people. And he relates to it personally, though. He invests in it by for himself personally to be a part of this rebuilding. And he knows something great will happen when they are able to rebuild those walls. Really, actually, at least three things that he knows is going to happen are going to happen if they can rebuild the walls. The first thing is they'll have a safer community. Safer community. And we know just putting up walls, you know, if we built walls around Astoria, which I think would look really cool. If we built walls around Astoria, we'd be safe from people coming, you know, for whoever wanted to take over Astoria. I don't know. But from the attacks from the outside, if you have a wall, just naturally you have a safer community. I was just imagining who would like to take over Astoria, but I'm sure there's somebody out there. All right. But we also know through the text that Nehemiah probably was building up a military force. He was building a fortress-like structure, and so they would be safer from attacks on the outside. But he also knew that they'd be building a better community. Having the walls would give them the safety so that they could build the administration. Nehemiah eventually would become, I think, called the governor of the community of that city. But he also had people under him and people under them that would build the administration and allow there to be some kind of a structure in that chaos. So to be a better community, but there also be a place to live and worship better. We see if we read through the rest of Nehemiah, which I encourage you to do if you haven't read Nehemiah. Read through the rest of Nehemiah, we'd see that Ezra, who has his own book in our Bibles, is going to come in and he's going to teach the people. He's going to reread the law. He's going to show them this is the way God instructed our people to live. And so through that, they're going to recommit to God's teachings and be in obedience to him. So we're going to have a place, a better place to live and worship. Let's keep reading in Nehemiah 2, verse 18. Nehemiah says, "I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, 'Let us start rebuilding.' And so they began his good work." I imagine, I think of someone getting up in front of a large group of people and saying, well, this is what we're going to do, and everybody in the whole group and the whole community said, let's do it. Let's start rebuilding. Last night I took a quiz to know which candidate I support the most in our upcoming presidential. I'm not going to tell you who I ended up aligning with. I don't know why I'm embarrassed, but but anyway, I'm not going to tell you who I ended up aligning with. But you know, if you think about it, if we had one person that could somehow rally the whole nation to do something, anything, and they got everybody going, how much we could accomplish. You know, right now it seems like we have 100 different candidates that are trying to accomplish something. You know, they want their own agenda to get passed. But just imagine the work if one person could rally everyone to accomplish something. And that's what Nehemiah is able to do. Right away he says, this is what we need to do. And they're like, let's do it. Let's do it. Start rebuilding those walls. And we can see Nehemiah looking at the history that he's gone through, the things that God has done and provided for, that God has led him to a place to where they're at now to start rebuilding those walls. And so he points to God's work, he points to the things that have happened, and we see that if we read the rest of Nehemiah, that in 52 days, just a couple of months, they're able to rebuild the wall. And so our book of Nehemiah, the first couple chapters, there's several things in there that are just an inspiring and amazing story. Allow us to see what breaks his heart. And if we continue reading, as we're going to go into chapter 3 reads a little bit more like a phone book than an inspiring story. But we're going to spend some time in there. If you just glanced at it in your Bibles, there's a ton of names. And it's a little bit of a struggle to get through that chapter, but it shows us in those stories that Nehemiah was able to do so much. He was a great delegator. People would actually come from different places around him, and he would give them work. He'd say, well, you go work on the Dung Gate, and you go work on the East Gate, you go work on the West Gate. And he'd delegate, and he'd pass along responsibility in such an amazing way. But then we have chapter 3 here, where it's a lot of names and a lot of things that happen, but we see Nehemiah's heart in it as well. Let's jump to verse 28 of chapter 3. It says, above the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. The priests made repairs, each in front of their own house. Excuse me. Anyway, we see it's interesting that Nehemiah specifically mentions the priest here. Right, we know what the priest's role are. If we look through the rest of the Old Testament, we see the priests, well, they're supposed to be in the temple and offering sacrifices and being available to the people in lots of different ways. Their job was not to build buildings. You know, we could probably say, well, the priests have every right to say, well, Nehemiah, you go hire a contractor or a construction worker, someone else that does this kind of work. I'm supposed to be in the temple doing my thing. I'm a priest. And if we read in verse 31, which we won't this morning, we'd see that the goldsmiths and the merchants, they also joined in building their part of the wall. Excuse me. We know then, looking at this, their occupation didn't influence their involvement. Their occupation didn't influence their involvement. We'll jump to verse 29 here. Next to them, Zadok, son of Immer, made repairs opposite his house. Sometimes it's fun, I think, to just stop and look and say, well, how would I feel if I was in their shoes? You know, jump into the character's role and how I would feel. And I look at this man, and we know nothing about him other than what I just read. He made repairs opposite his house. But my guess is he wasn't nearly as passionate about building that wall as Nehemiah was. He probably didn't have that same conviction. He probably didn't have that same excitement going on in his life that Nehemiah had. But you know what? He didn't argue. He didn't complain. He just jumped in and said, I'm going to build repair in front of my house. Didn't have the same conviction, didn't have the same excitement that Nehemiah had, but joined in the effort as well. Let's keep reading in verse 29. Next to him, Shemaiah, son of Shechaniah, I'm making these up as I go, Shechaniah, the guard the guard at the east gate made repairs. I don't know how to read names in the Old Testament any more than anybody else, so just so you don't feel bad if you struggle with them. No, Shemaiah, the guard at the east gate made repairs. If you think about the turmoil that's going on at that time, the things that are happening around them, they're actually, if we read the rest of Nehemiah, and I think I've said that 3 or 4 times, right? If you read the rest of Nehemiah, you'll hear this. But if you read the rest of Nehemiah, you'll see that it's there's chaos all around them. You know, not having walls automatically gives them kind of an open door to their enemies. But we also know in the rest of Nehemiah that they, at times, were carrying swords or spears in their one hand and trying to rebuild the wall with their other hand. I mean, there's so much chaos. They're being mocked because of the work that they're trying to do. And so a guard would have been a busy man. A guard would have been a busy man, probably lengthy patrols. I'm assuming a lot here, obviously. Lengthy patrols, not having days off, but a guard is still going to join in the rebuilding effort, despite his schedule, despite his busyness. We see, though, in these examples, that the people simply found where they lived, looked right in front of them, and worked right there. See some more of that here in verse 30. Next to him, Hananiah, son of Shalemiah, and Hanun, the sixth son of Zaloph, repaired another section. And next to them, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, made repairs opposite his living quarters. I always love variations in lists like this, because it obviously is saying something. There's something happening. Why is his living quarters and not a house? Is he renting the property, or is there something else going on? Well, we're going to assume, and I think I've read this in one of my books, that he was actually just renting quarters. And my family and I, we've rented several places in our lives. And there's kind of roles that you take in a rental place, right? Some places you're responsible for, well, you're going to mow and you're gonna shovel the driveway, the snow off, and you're going to do all these other things. But when that furnace goes out, you're going to make a call to the landlord right away, right? There's just certain roles, and we keep the guys busy over at the parsonage too, just so, you know, we try to make sure they don't get bored. But, you know, we call the landlord. We have someone else take care of it. And I think, I look at Meshulam, if he's just renting it, what responsibility does he have to that wall? Is it his responsibility, is it his role to take care of that? And whether it is or not, he decides he's going to be a part of it. And so we get all these people, and we can go through the whole list of all these different things that people are doing, and we could say, you know, everybody's doing their own part. And I was reminded of Christmas, and I think, you know, every year I have to decide how much or if I'm going to do Christmas lights, right? And some of that's dictated on the neighbors, right? And when we lived over here on Broadway, I just remember that we had a neighbor that cheated. And I say cheated because he cheated. But it's not a competition. My wife tells me it's not a competition, but it is a competition. And so what he would do, and like I said, you guys probably have them, and they're not bad. They look nice, but they're cheating. They just grab one of those big inflatable things, and they throw out the big inflatable things and plug it in. And that's it. That's all they do. And like I said, they look nice, but, and like I said, I say they're cheating because I can't afford to buy those things. So I have to be more creative. But you don't have to go through the work and risking life and limb to hang up those lights if you just throw one of those out there. And so anyway, just imagine Christmas lights. That has nothing to do with anything. But imagine the Christmas lights. And if your neighbor next to you was like the National Lampoon, the whatever that family is, I couldn't come up with the name before, but that National Lampoon's Christmas, where he just, the house could be seen from space, right? The lights are so big on one side. And the other side, they kind of go to the same extreme. And in the middle, well, I've got a wreath with some lights hanging on it, right on the front door. You know, and they drive by and they say, well, the Thiners didn't try very hard this year, right? And in comparison to those incredible light shows, you know, in the middle, there's nothing going on. And I think some of the people probably felt that way in Nehemiah's time. They see their neighbors saying, oh, I'm going to take care of my part of the wall, and the other side taking care of their part of the wall. Well, what do I do with my part of the wall? Who's going to fix my part of the wall? And Nehemiah would have said, well, you know what? You probably care the most about that part of the wall. You probably care the most about that part of the wall. Maybe you should be the one that rebuilds it. That being said, if anyone wants to volunteer and decorate my house for Christmas next year, thank you, Mary. Well, thank you. We'll see if that happens next year. Thank you, Nicole, though. All right. So we look at The Griswolds, thank you. I was trying to come up with it, Griswold. But if we look at our community, if we look at the things going on around us, and we look at our neighborhood, we can ask this question. We can say, you know, when we don't know where to work, when the people of Nehemiah's time didn't know where to work, they simply worked on what was right in front of them. And so when we look again at our neighborhood, you know, what's right in front of us? In our homes, what's right in front of us? In our community, what's right in front of us? And in our church, what's right in front of us? You know, the church as a whole had a lot of parallels to what would happen in Nehemiah's culture and his community once those walls went up. The parallels are striking. First, there's in a church we should find safety. And that's not safety of a building, obviously. Against an attack, I don't think our walls would hold very well, but we're warm inside, right, and it's nice and everything. But no, safety is how we relate to one another. The relationships that we share with each other. The people of the church. This is just a building. This isn't the church. All of us are the church. And so we need to find safety because we know that that growth and learning and development are hindered when there's fear, when there's a lack of safety. When we find safety in the people around us, new ideas can be expressed because they're accepted, or at least they're listened to. New ways of doing things aren't always immediately rejected. Ever since I've kind of started here, or even before I came, in my mind, I've always had these goals. And they're not board approved, they're not published or anything like that, but just kind of in the back of my mind. Some things that I would like to see our church be in. One of them is that we focus on creating environments. A safe, a loving, and encouraging, a fun environment. Rather than focusing on filling programs or just doing things because we think we should. Really being purposeful about the type of environments that we have. And a big part of that has to do with safety. And not just safety within our churches, but community. Working together, finding ways to include each other and to do our part. Really having that personal relationship. And I look around and I know there's several of us here this morning, several of you this morning, that are involved in boards and in councils and doing various things in the community and through the church, and I think that's awesome. You know, continue to do that. Keep doing that. Christians should be leaders in those things. Well, what I want to challenge myself with and with you guys, I know I've sat on boards and on councils and stuff, and it's easy to say, well, this is what we're going to decide, and then just kind of that's the way it is. What I want to do, what I encourage you guys to be a part of, is that instead of just being on the board, which we should be on, is finding personal ways of individual interaction. I think of our government, I think, well, Washington, D.C. makes a lot of policies and laws that impact us way over here in Illinois. And I feel like we can accept it, we can be a part of that, we can even enjoy the things that they're doing and the things that they're making as laws if we can have a conversation and be heard, to have that individual interaction some way with people. Having that relationship, working together is a huge part of that community. There was an evening that a man was driving down a country road and he loses control of his car and he winds up in a ditch. So he crawls out and goes to the closest farm and asks for help pulling the car out. And the farmer says, well, sure, let me just hitch up Dusty and we'll be out there and you'll be out in no time. A few minutes later, the farmer appears with Dusty, who's an old, sway-backed, almost blind mule. After Dusty was hitched to the car, the old farmer, he cracks the whip and he says, pull, Buck, pull. Nothing happens. The stranger looks around for a mule named Buck, but there wasn't any mule but old Dusty. And old Dusty, well, he wasn't moving. The farmer cracked the whip again and said, pull, Clyde, pull. Again, the stranger looks around for a mule named Clyde, but there was just old Dusty and nothing was happening. Finally, the farmer cracks the whip a third time and says, pull, Dusty, pull. And Dusty begins to pull. until the car is finally out of the ditch. And the stranger, the man, asked the farmer, "Well, I'm really confused. If the mule's name is Dusty, why did you say Pull Buck and Pull Clyde? That just doesn't make any sense." And the farmer says, "Well, you know, Dusty's old and doesn't see too good, and really he just doesn't have the confidence that he used to. You know, if he thought he was doing all the work by himself, well, he wouldn't even try." And so we need each other. We need to work together. If I feel like I'm the only one doing something, if you feel like you're the only one doing something, it becomes a lot harder to do the work. But we also get from our church, we also get life and worship. Hallmarks of life, a couple of hallmarks of life are change and growth. And growth doesn't always mean physical growth or numerical growth. They a lot of times focus on knowledge or especially on character and relationships. And we need to have that growth. We need to have that life within our church. And if we look at our purpose for being created, all of creation, humans especially though, our purpose in creation is to worship. And if we don't find God who deserves our worship, we'll find something else to worship. And the goal for me in this community, the goal for us as a community is to dedicate ourselves to God and to focus on Him as the most meaningful and worshipful being that we can have in our lives. In our relationships that we have in our church, our focus then obviously should be on the worship of God in our gatherings, but also in our individual lives. And so just as important as the wall is to the people in Nehemiah's time, the church is very important for us this morning. And so what I'd like to close with this morning are three things that we say, three excuses that we give when we come to, well, what should I do about my broken heart? Or seeing a need in our community or in our church, we give these excuses. And so if you find yourself in there, I know I found myself in these on occasion, I challenge you and encourage you to think through why do we feel that way? Maybe our first excuse is, well, it's not my job. We look at Nehemiah's time, we saw the merchants and the priests and the goldsmiths all being a part of rebuilding the wall. And so they never said, it's not my job, but we can get caught up in that. We've established, maybe a lot of us have said, well, this is my job and I'm not going to go any further. And we should set boundaries. We should have a certain spot where we say, well, I'm going to serve here. But being flexible in that, being able to have other responsibilities on occasion can be a helpful thing too. And something I've found in more traditional churches especially is this idea of that the pastor or the elders or the Sunday school teacher, they get to do the spiritual things. Right, have the spiritual duties in our church. And I guess I focus on something that is called the priesthood of all believers. And I feel like there's so much more that we can do as a people if we're able to say, well, I can teach others about Jesus. I can share my experience of Jesus with others. Even if that includes being a part of baptisms or whatever it involves. Not to say that I don't want to, because I love doing that. I kind of actually want everyone else to do it so that you can experience the joy that comes with that. I love, you know, talking about people and their faith and helping people to work through things in that way. So I'm not trying to get out of anything by any means at all, but I think there's so much power if we can all be a part of that. Stepping outside of what we feel like is our job to do what needs to be done. And so we can say, well, it's not my job, but we can also say, well, I'm not convicted to do that. I don't feel convicted to do that. And this is a tricky one a little bit because I feel like there's importance to knowing that we're convicted, right? We want to do things that are important. We want to do things that follow our heart. But at the same time, there might be a spot where that doesn't fit in exactly, because I look at, and I'm just to be honest, I guess, hopefully this comes out okay. When I first started here 9 years ago as a youth pastor, I had very little of any experience with kids under, like, sixth grade. And there were various reasons why I wanted to do youth ministry And one of them reasons was had nothing to do with conviction as far as really enjoying and loving kids at that time. I know that sounds awful. It worked out. I think it worked out okay. So hopefully this goes all right. But anyway, I wasn't convicted that I wanted to be a children's pastor or even a youth pastor. I always wanted to be a preaching senior minister. That was always what my heart was set on. But for a time, for a season in my life, I stepped into that role. And I, like I said, I didn't know a thing about working with kids and very little working with high school, middle school even. But I stepped into that role, and even now, especially now in my life, I am just so glad I did that because they grew so much on me. I have a joy and excitement working with kids. I love it. I think it's so much fun, so meaningful and so worthwhile to be a part of that. And I don't think I would have ever felt that way. I shouldn't say that. Maybe I would have. But being a part of a youth ministry, leading that youth ministry, was huge for me to develop into that. I didn't feel convicted about it. I didn't feel even maybe led to do that particular ministry in that way, but I stepped into it, and it's been such a blessing in my life. And so sometimes we don't feel convicted to do something, but we step into it, and it can be a huge blessing in our life. Our last excuse is we can say, well, I simply don't have time. I simply don't have time. And you know, I could talk about this for a long time, but I'm going to keep it short and just say, we're going to struggle with that always. Always going to struggle with that, but we tend to find time for the things that are important to us. Right? Find time for things that are important to us. And so if we feel like this is something that's broken our heart, if we feel like something is important enough, we'll make time for it. And so to use that as an excuse, to use that as something that keeps us away from serving or from loving others, I think it's just that. It's just an excuse. And so what I want to finish up with this morning is a story. But before we get to that, I want us to focus on, and this is my hope and my hope for you as well, is that if we look at the rest of our life, if we look at what's going to happen in the future, we need to focus on making the rest of our life the best of our life. And one way, one primary way we can do that is to work on what's right in front of us. In a Midwestern town, Miss Jones had the distinction of being the oldest resident in town. So when she died, the editor of the local paper wanted to print a little article remembering that dear old lady. But when he sat down to write the article, well, he couldn't think of anything to say. Miss Jones never had done anything terribly wrong, spending a night in jail or getting drunk or any of those big things. But on the other hand, she had never done anything significant at all. So with this still on his mind, he goes down to the local cafe and runs into the funeral director, who was having the same trouble. He had wanted to put something on her tombstone other than Miss Nancy Jones died such and such a date, born such and such a date, died such and such a date, and he couldn't think of anything either. And so the editor went back to his office, and he said, well, I'm just going to assign this responsibility to whichever reporter I see first. And the first reporter he runs into is the sports editor, who got the assignment. So somewhere in some little community in the Midwest, there's a tombstone which reads, "Here lies the bones of Nancy Jones. For her life held no terrors. She lived an old maid, she died an old maid. No hits, no runs, no errors." I know on my tombstone, maybe it'd be funny to put that on my tombstone, so I'm tempted to, but you know, none of us want to have no hits, no runs, no errors put on our tombstone. You know, I said a few weeks ago that my goal, and I think our goal should be that at the end of our life, I want people to line up and thank me for blank. And so maybe that blank can be something that's right in front of you, in your home, in your neighborhood, in our community, in your church. And so I just pray, my prayer is for myself, for all of us this morning, that collectively, working together, we're able to rebuild the wall. Let's pray. Gracious Father, thank you so much for the story of Nehemiah and for the inspiration that he is for the people, was for the people back then, but also for our lives. Help us to look right in front of us, to say, well, there is a need there. Let me start rebuilding right there. If it's in front of us, It's probably the most important to us. We just pray your guidance, your direction, and your spirit in that. In your son Jesus' name, amen.